And we will be spending some time today looking back, because tomorrow, of course, marks 20 years since the towers fell in New York. The Pentagon was hit. Kyria's Rachel Bell spoke with a local couple who were in New York on that day and saw it in person.
It was the morning of September 11th, 2001, and Emily Churkin was headed to her job near the World Trade Center.
I was cranky, I was running late, and then the subways were delayed. And I was so mad. My first emotion was just like irritation.
I got out of the subway and I could immediately tell something was going on. There was cops everywhere. People were running.
That's Ben Gittenstein. He was headed to his office in Union Square.
We finally emerged over the bridge, and I just remember this collective gasp as people looked out of the window, saw all this smoke. It's the Trade Center. The Trade Center is burning.
It's 8:52 here in New York. I'm Brian Gumbel. We understand that there has been a plane crash, and you're looking at the World Trade Center. We understand that a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center. We don't know anything more than that. We don't know if it was a commercial aircraft.
I got out of the subway. It was like a salmon spawning upstream. You know, like everybody is going the opposite direction and like running, not just walking, like running the other direction. And then I saw someone from my office and she said, the courthouse is closed. Go home.
So Emily got back on the subway and went back to Brooklyn.
Now remember, oh my God.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane.
Oh my goodness, there's another one.
This seems to be on purpose.
Now it's obvious. I think we have a terrorist act.
I watched the second tower collapse. Like, I watched it fall. Your mind does not know how to process that. To be honest, I thought it was fake.
And I will never forget the screaming of sirens, like police cars, ambulances, fire trucks. And I realized that the towers probably were going to fall at that point. And I made a very intentional decision not to look. I just decided I didn't want that memory of watching them fall.
Emily and Ben were 22 years old. They were working at their first real jobs out of college, and they were falling in love.
I was frantic trying to figure out where she was. Like, I kept calling her number and she wouldn't answer, or just wouldn't go through.
It was all about trying to get in touch with Ben, and we did reconnect. He ended up walking across the Williamsburg Bridge.
There were thousands of us. Giant march of human beings.
A mass exodus from Manhattan. Everybody just getting out.
I mean, I was surrounded by office workers. We all had our sport coats over our arm and our shirts unbuttoned, and we were all hot and tired from walking in shoes that weren't meant to be walked in. And it was very quiet. Everybody was scared and confused. And what I remember was that when we got over the bridge, all these Hasidic Jews came out with black hats and tallises and the whole thing, and they were handing out water to people as they walked across the bridge.
Emily and Ben were a new couple.
Our first date was sometime in like June of 2001. Mm-hmm. I probably have it in my journal to the exact day. But yeah, it was only a couple months.
It's funny to hear you say that we'd only been together for 3 months, because in my mind, when 9/11 happened, we'd been dating for years. When we first met, I immediately knew that I was going to be with this person for a very long time.
How did you know?
Sometimes you meet a person and you didn't realize that's what you'd been looking for, but you're like, oh, that's what they're supposed to be like.
When I finally reconnected with Ben that day, we ended up going out for lunch. And I remember just sitting there and being like, I'm eating lunch at a restaurant and people are dying, literally dying right now, or died an hour ago, massive number of them. And I'm just doing this weird, normal thing. I think reconciling that, you know, how do you live when people are dying?
The fear and the trauma of the terrorist attack instantly brought them closer together.
What we realized later was
everybody we knew who was dating somebody on 9/11 either got married
or broke up
within a few weeks.
It was very clarifying. You either desperately wanted to be with that person and make sure they were okay, or you were like, you know, I don't think they're that important to me.
It's really weird to me, looking back, how much of the foundation of our relationship was because of and related to 9/11. It was the vulnerability was what made us close.
Emily kept a detailed diary during this time.
You want me to read this?
Yeah,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
He said it. At 12:30 p.m. in the sunshine in Union Square Park, standing by a black wire fence overlooking ducks and squirrels on the grass. I thought I almost didn't hear him right. I said, what? And he whispered, you heard me. I buried my face in his chest, unsure whether to laugh or cry. I clung to him and whispered back, I love you too.
It is kind of romantic to be in a disaster movie. But here's an example. I think it was about 2 weeks after the event, Emily was spending the night over at my apartment, and there was a gas line leak in our neighborhood. Manhole covers started exploding upwards underneath cars and setting off the car alarms and lighting the cars on fire.
It sounded like a bomb. And in that moment, it was just like, oh, it probably is. We were so raw, on edge.
Freaked out. You just hold each other really close. And it's like really intense. That kind of fear is kind of, it's romantic.
20 years later, Emily and Ben are married, living in Seattle, raising two children. Emily said she was recently triggered by the trauma of 9/11. After the towers fell, smoke lingered in Brooklyn for months.
After a couple weeks, we would sort of open our door and be like, wow, I smell the Trade Center today. And so I think for me, the connection to the wildfire smoke that we're getting here in Seattle, I mean, I feel it physically, like my ears will swell, and that's what happened in New York. But it's just that connection, a reminder of something traumatic.
When COVID started, I don't know that it triggered 9/11 feelings, but when we had to leave our offices pretty suddenly, when my kids had to leave their school suddenly and come home, and it's not so much that it triggered 9/11 feelings so much as it felt familiar to me. It was sort of like, okay, yeah, the things you take for granted can sometimes disappear.
Rachel Bell, what a story.
Yeah.
A little ray of light in the midst of that horrible disaster.
Absolutely. And really, of course, gives us perspective on what we're going through right now. Whether you feel the trauma or not, the trauma's there. And that idea of really clarifying what's important in life.
Yeah.
I know that happened for me, right? I took a whole month off in July because it was so clarifying to me that I needed to reassess my life. So, you know, Rachel's story is important for us to hear, because if you haven't taken stock yet of your life, the time is now. This pandemic's not ending anytime soon.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
And our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map, which is a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places and things. And this week, his subject is that time in the early 1980s when SeaTac Airport just disappeared for 6 months.
Hey, Dave. Yeah, it was 38 years ago, September 1st, 1983, when longtime Democratic U.S. Senator from the great state of Washington, Henry M. Scoop Jackson, native son of Everett and somewhat hawkish lawmaker, guy who always had Boeing's back, he passed away suddenly and unexpectedly at his home on Grand Avenue of an aortic aneurysm. He was 71. His death came in the aftermath of the shooting down by the Soviet Union of a Korean Airlines 747 near Sakhalin Island. It's a pretty scary time in the Cold War. That 747, of course, was built right there in Everett, and all 269 people aboard were lost. Senator Jackson had just spoken at a press conference and condemned the downing of the plane. Now, on September 13th, as a tribute to the senator, but without really consulting anybody, the Port of Seattle Commission voted to change the name of SeaTac to Henry M. Jackson International Airport. Boom, just like that. Remember, they even changed that time and temperature sign that used to be on the median there as you approach from the north on that little freeway. Mm-hmm. Said Henry M. Jackson and the time and the temperature. Huge public outcry followed. Tacoma people in particular and Port of Tacoma, they felt particularly angry having the city's name taken off the airport, since that was part of the original deal struck back in 1942 or 43 to build and help fund the airport. There were letters to the editor against it. There were polls showing 5-1 in favor of changing the name back. They even had an advisory ballot in Tacoma in November 83 on restoring the name, which was approved by a margin of 4-1. One of the worries was that the short version of the name, Jackson Airport, would be confused with Mississippi, or just completely detached from any reference to Seattle or Tacoma. In the port election that November, two incumbents were defeated, and the name controversy was at least partially blamed. Now, the Port Commission held a public meeting on February 15th, 1984, at the old Renton Sheraton. This was their first public meeting since the name change, and they got an earful. Finally, on February 28th, 1984, the commission voted 3-2 to change the name back. So it was just short of 6 months that we had Henry M. Jackson International Airport. If you look at the old newspaper clippings, all the news out of that airport in those months, they call it Henry M. Jackson Airport. You don't see the name SeaTac anywhere. One little bit of good news. WashDOT, they decided early on to wait things out and not change any signage on I-5 or 405 or 509.
Smart move.
But, yeah, and by doing so, they figured they saved somewhere between $30,000 and $40,000.
There you go.
So, did you covered that? Weren't you working at Cairo then, Dave?
I was working at it, and I'd forgotten completely until just now.
That's why I'm here.
Yes, it is. And by the way, so how does Tacoma feel now that the official name is SEA?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I've talked to the Port of Seattle public affairs people. That SEA, that's sort of the international brand. It's still the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport.
Oh, I see.
But they say SEA is what the airport's known as globally. Okay. So SeaTac, that name's not going anywhere, but they're always tinkering with branding. And that SEA launch came right before the pandemic. So it's kind of unclear how that will play out once air travel returns to back to normal, whenever that's going to happen.
Have a good weekend, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
All of Felix's features at MyNorthwest.com. It's been about 4 months since we've heard from Margaret Brennan, who hosts Face the Nation, but she is back from maternity leave. And it's probably an understatement to say a lot's changed in that time. I asked her if she thought we would still be this deep into a pandemic in early September.
When I went on leave at the end of April, I thought that the vaccines that we had really just started rolling out, you know, I got my second shot a week before I gave birth, that it would have made more of a dent. But as you heard the president say yesterday, still 80 million unvaccinated. He's referring to adults there. My big question is, what about my little guys?
Yeah.
You know, my 4-month-old, my 3-year-old who's going into a preschool classroom and can't be vaccinated. So it's a question I think a lot about. And I thought we'd be in a different place.
Yeah. Well, yesterday, the president took the gloves off. And even though he did not want to blame the unvaccinated, or so he said a while back, now he basically is. Mm-hmm. And so he announced these various requirements. The RNC, Republican National Committee, has already decided to sue over his vaccination mandate.
Yeah.
I don't know. At some point, don't they risk looking like they're pro-pandemic?
Well, the chairwoman of the RNC, Ronna McDaniel, said she is pro-vaccine but anti-mandate. So this is, again, one of these culture war issues that may have some political consequences. The White House is arguing on a practical point that they think by ordering businesses to make their workers either get tested once a week if they're not vaccinated, or get the vaccine, or potentially pay a fine, that they will give political cover to businesses. Many of them were already doing this, right? Some of the nation's biggest corporations. But it is the state. It is your local municipality who gets to decide the vaccines that your kids get when they walk into a classroom, right? You got to fill out all those forms. And so it is the parameter of the state and local governments. The White House is going to the business community to sort of give them political cover and roll this out in a practical sense. I think another question is blowback on the political front among communities of color who have been vaccine hesitant. Does this mandate to saying to keep your job, you need a jab, for example, does that actually blow back? Does it do what the president intends? We'll have to see.
Yeah. On other big issues that develop while you were out, Afghanistan in particular, and you're married to a Marine, so I'm sure you have a pretty deep perspective on this. I was reading the piece in Politico this morning where they talked to, I believe, 5 or 6 military people, all of whom knew that for a long time that the operation wasn't going well, that we were trying to impose an American-style military on a nation that just was not prepared for it. Was there a problem here with the brass and then the civilian supervision of the military getting a message that the rank and file people knew for a long time?
Well, you know, there has been some pretty deep reporting on this. Washington Post had a big piece a few years ago revealing a lot of what commanders were saying at the time privately that wasn't necessarily getting communicated publicly, being frank with each other. And, you know, it didn't have a big political splash when that reporting was revealed. Perhaps the public wasn't tracking it as much. But it has been discussed, and there have been tough questions for some time about exactly what is or what was the mission in Afghanistan. Was it to help set up a functioning government? Was it simply there to contain terrorism? Is it there to have a presence between 3 existing nuclear powers and potentially on the border of a potential nuclear power with Iran? You know, exactly what is the mission set? And that's been the messy part for the past few presidents, none of whom have really wanted to pull the plug fully. And the Biden administration's taking a big gamble in saying that that they can contain the terror threat of a potential failed state or civil war in Afghanistan and keep terrorists at bay with a long arm through drone strikes, through dropping bombs, through intelligence in a way that they say they've been able to do for the past 20 years because we had boots on the ground. So that's what we're going to have to wait and see.
Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. 20 years ago tomorrow, I was on the air, Dory Monson was on the air, Heather Bosch was on the air, and a young historian named Felix Bunnell was rolling tape, and here he is now. Hi, Felix.
Hey, morning, Dave. Yeah, it's hard to believe it's been 20 years, and long before I worked at Cairo or worked at a history museum, I would press record on a tape recorder when stuff was going on in local news because I thought someday I might be able to play it on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, so I got some samples that I pulled from the tapes of that day. I don't have the moment where the plane struck or when the news broke because I think what's more interesting is sort of what comes not long after, whether it's the news and then the analysis that Cairo has been so good at for so many years. Let's start off with just this fairly straightforward report from a very young Heather Bosch about what's going on at the city of Seattle.
Mayor Paul Schell says he's been in contact with military leaders, and Schell says there will be a Navy ship stationed in Elliott Bay. He wouldn't give any more details where the ship comes from or what kind it will be. He said, don't be alarmed, though. If you see that military ship out in Elliott Bay, that's where it will be stationed, as he says, a precaution. Also, we can tell you now that the urban search and rescue team based here in the Puget Sound region will be leaving around 5 p.m. from McCord Air Force Base to New York to do what this team does probably better than anybody else in the world, which is to search for people in collapsed buildings and other difficult situations. So they'll be taking off around 5. The mayor then added that he wants everyone to pray for the president and members of Congress who he says, quote, will be making some very difficult decisions in the coming days. He then added that he wants us all to pray for the victims of this terrorist attack. Live in downtown Seattle, Heather Bosch, News Radio 710 Cairo.
See, and that's what people like Heather do best of all. They just get in there and just start giving you the facts. And, of course, we were on AM radio back then, so even the phone call doesn't sound as good as it would sound on FM just a few years later. As the day progressed, you had your show from 9 to noon. Dory was on, you know, same from noon to 3. And Dory sort of got into the emotional part of it. And he's not emotional in this, what we're going to hear here, but he talks about how the emotions were at work at that time of the day.
I think a lot of people today would say, and this is emotion that is talking today, and hopefully whatever the American response is will be a reasoned one. But I think right now, the emotion of the moment has Americans saying that we must strike back 100 times stronger than the force with which we were struck. Because that is the only way to stop terrorism. Now, again, that's an emotional response. What is the most practical response? That will be evaluated, but there will be a response. You can be sure of that.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if we still know the answer to what what the most rational response is here 20 years later. You know, it's interesting. I looked at that time like 20 years after Pearl Harbor and how different it is because in 1961, we'd vanquished Japan and Germany, our World War II enemies. But we were still battling the Soviets, and we had the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis. So it wasn't as if everything was fixed after World War II. We had a whole different set of problems. But it's different now, 20 years after 9/11. I went back earlier this summer and talked with some of the elected officials who were in office 20 years ago just to get their memories. Chris Gregoire, though she wasn't yet governor, she was attorney general, and I asked her what her morning was like on September 11th, 2001.
Of course, I went into work immediately and began to ask the question, did they start on the East Coast? Are they coming to the West Coast? Knowing that we have some vulnerabilities here and some significance, particularly, for example, with a Boeing plant, would there be further activity? Should we expect it? What was going to be shut down? What were citizens supposed to do? How should we respond to all of that? And I remember having, as I recall, a conversation with the governor. Is there anything that you need from us at the Attorney General's office, legal or otherwise? We stand ready to help you in anything you may need.
Yeah, and that uncertainty, that not knowing the bulk of the narrative, that was, so much was unknown on the morning of 9/11. They thought there might be tens of thousands of people who died in the World Trade Center. Yeah. And people started to assume it was Osama bin Laden, but we just didn't really know as much as we knew even a week or so later. I also talked with Secretary of State Sam Reed. He drew a comparison to the Nisqually earthquake, which had happened earlier that year.
This made me more aware, as did the Nisqually earthquake, that the staff and some of the public were looking at me to see if I would remain calm, if I would remain focused, if I wouldn't kind of, you know, panic a bit or something, and kind of reassuring them that you know, everything's going to be okay. We're going to move forward. We need to focus on what we need to do.
And Ron Sims was King County executive then, and he got the, you know, he saw on the news early that morning, and then he looked outside, and there was one of the special King County armored cars to pick him up and haul him down to the emergency center down somewhere in the south part of the county. I think they call that place the Rock. I couldn't get him to tell me where it is exactly. But he, you know, looking back on it 20 years later, he says nobody in King County was harmed on that day, and that was a big plus for him.
9/11 has its own universe, and you got to understand that nothing bad came out of it. So when you watch professional orchestration and talent applied to make sure that there's not a single citizen in this county, not in a daycare facility, not in a child care facility, not in a nursing home facility, not in a hospital, not at a school building, not at a grocery store. When you know that people made sure that no one was harmed, oh, wow, you walk out feeling really, really good.
Yeah, and that was a really interesting sort of long view and very localized view from Ron Sims. Now, the bulk of the tape that I have is from your 9 to noon show, Dave. And you said a lot of brilliant things. I don't mind saying that. You know, I'm not trying to buddy you up or anything.
Of course not.
But we've missed you. It's nice to have you back, by the way.
Thank you.
This is some observations you made about having grown up in New York and what you were feeling on that morning 20 years ago.
This is the rogue attack we've been told so much about. And yet, from the experts we've heard and talked to this morning, how could you have prevented it? It didn't come via missile. It came via passenger jets in areas which are heavily traveled by passenger jets all the time. There will... somebody who grew up in the New York area and has visited New York City to see something like this, there's really nothing you can say except that you're upset, you're in shock, you're angry. I've got friends in New York. I don't know what's happened to them. They may have been working. I don't know. I've called my parents already. They were upstate, but there will be many, many other phone calls which will not be returned in the same fashion. And it is just beginning. This will go on for months. It will go on for years.
Yeah. How do you feel hearing your voice from 20 years ago saying those words?
It's funny because I avoid 9/11 news, because if the following I went to New York the weekend after it happened and spent some time down there and talking to firefighters and relief workers and just walking around the pile and walking around New York, and just remember looking at all those high rises and saying this, any one of these things could be so easily hit. The vulnerability that made me feel was very uncomfortable. And now looking back and realizing some of the mistakes we made in response to it and not being able to take any of that back, I find the whole thing frustrating.
Yeah.
I myself will probably mostly be avoiding media over the weekend. I know I shouldn't be saying that, but that's just the way I feel.
Well, for me, it's like the narrative's not complete. With World War II, the narrative has kind of a beginning, middle, and end, and we can sort of, it's not satisfying. Obviously, hundreds of thousands of people died in World War II. But like the pandemic, 9/11 doesn't have a final chapter. We're still sort of stuck in this loop of living history, which, as a historian, I don't really want to live history. I want to study it and talk about it. Yeah. Living through it is exhausting, and I feel like we're still living through it 20 years later.
So true. Felix Bonnell. Felix, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. When someone broke a 6-year-old boy's bike, two police officers stepped in. Cole Collins' bike was completely wrecked in this case. One of the pedals was lying in the grass. The back tire was bent. Cole told CBS affiliate WBBM-TV.
One of the wheels were bent and the training wheels were broken.
It was a scary scene, too. A neighbor was having mental health issues and destroyed Cole's bike in the process, throwing it on the ground during that disturbance.
I was kind of getting mad and sad because my bike was broken.
Park Forest Police Officer Jennifer Keith was on duty that
day. We responded. We spoke with the mom, and she didn't want to take any kind of action against that person.
But Officer Keith didn't quite let it go.
You could just see it in his face that, like, his heart was broke.
A lot of work was needed to get that bike running again. So she and her partner got to work. They loaded up Cole's bike in the cruiser, then repaired, exchanged, and screwed in a new bike part. And the back of the police station, in between calls, they fixed it up. Hours later, the job was complete, and they visited
Cole. Thank you for fixing my bike.
You're welcome.
But Officer Keith and the department said for them, it's a lot bigger than
that.
Our
intent is, like, we want to build a relationship with kids because those are the people that we intend to see in the community later.
Ah, what an example of community policing, and a great one at that. Bike stories always get me because my bike was stolen when I was a young girl.
Aww.
Left it on the side of my, and my parents didn't replace it. That was sort of because my responsibility was to protect my bike. So anytime I hear about a kid without a bike or a stolen bike or a broken bike, my heart goes out to them. It's personal trauma, you see.
They were blaming the victim, though. You didn't destroy the bike.
Well, you know what? In hindsight, you know, at 10 years old, I was so bitter, and I didn't understand why I couldn't get another bike. But as an adult now with children, I understand. They said, it's your responsibility. I did not do that. And therefore, that was the consequence.
Raised in the school of hard knocks, you were.
And to this day, I'm an adult that can't ride a bike. I'm just kidding. I can ride a bike.
.748, the Seattle Seahawks start the 2021 season on the road in Indianapolis. And joining us live from Jake and Stacy, which you can hear weekdays at 10 on 710 ESPN Seattle, is Stacy Rost. Now, my big question is, when do we ever face Tampa Bay? Did you watch that game last night, by the way?
I did. It was fantastic.
It was unbelievable. And somebody needs to just teach Tom Brady a lesson. I mean, do we get to do that anytime this season?
No.
We don't.
I don't believe that Seattle is facing Tampa Bay.
That's too bad. All right, so how is the team looking this year?
You know what? I'll say that a lot like last year so far. So they're returning a lot of veterans. So the good news for them is that they were a 12-win team last year, and they didn't really lose any, like, significant guys. If anything, they brought in a new offensive coordinator, and if that works out, that hopefully solves one of their biggest problems, which wasn't personnel. It was like a lack of ability to adjust and make the most of their personnel. So if that ends up working, they're looking fantastic. The big question is just on defense.
Right. Where is Russell Wilson's head these days? Because, you know, we were all on pins and needles when he was being dramatic, or his agent was being dramatic about him not happy on the Seahawks, and then that just went away like it was a ghost that some of us saw and some of us didn't. You know what happened?
Well, what happened is that the season started, and if there's one thing that athletes are fantastic at, it's compartmentalizing things. It's just tabling things for later, not getting to it. So in my opinion, this isn't something that is completely resolved. This is something that is, hey, you know, let's figure out if we can make this work, you know, and see if this is a step forward. It sounds like Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll had an off-season conversation. I would assume that it was a conversation about either, you know, investing more in the offensive line and protection, or in, you know, if I were to guess, trying to make the offense a bit more efficient in a way that Wilson truly believes they can be. So if they end up doing that this year, I see no reason why issues in the relationship would continue, because it's like, well, you got what you wanted. If they end up, you know, let's say Pete Carroll inserts himself into a lot of the offensive game planning, well, you might have a return of some of those issues. And once again, you hear this story next year.
Okay, so the bottom line is Russell will be freer to call his own plays. Is that what you're saying?
I think it's going to be more freer, and this is all my opinion, more free to be a part of game planning, have a say in game planning. So Pete Carroll is a defensive-minded head coach who has had also, because he's head coach, a big control over the offense he wants. And as a defensive guy, his big plan has been like, hey, run the ball, be physical, but protect the football, have a great defense. Well, for Russell Wilson and from his point of view, he's like, hey, you can't really do that in today's NFL unless you've got like an elite defense. So what if we try this? I think that is the direction I'm guessing that that conversation
Well, I was reading a piece over the weekend that said in today's NFL, speed is everything. You're looking for people who can catch the ball and then just outrun anybody else on the field. And then, of course, by extension, you have to have a defense that can also run fast and keep up with those guys. Now, are we equipped for that kind of game?
That's a good question. I think that the Seahawks have made some improvement there. So, for instance, Dee Eskridge is a wide receiver they drafted in the second round this year. He is known for his speed. He's a really fast guy, and he's going to add that element for you. Hypothetically, you got a little younger on defense, which should bring speed. You also miss out on experience. So we'll see if the trade-off for them there works out.
Who are the superstars this year? Because, Stacey, I was so spoiled joining Cairo Radio in the year of their first Super Bowl win. And so I jumped on that bandwagon so fast. And then we slowly said goodbye to all of the superstars and all of the outspoken media stars. And I'm looking forward to that feeling again. I need to, you know, spark some interest in my relationship with the Seahawks. Who am I watching?
Well, obviously, you're watching Russell Wilson, Bobby Wagner, the two most prominent players and the only two players left from that Super Bowl team. But also Jamal Adams, a huge star. I mean, they kind of mortgaged the future to bring him in here. Him succeeding isn't just a big hope for them and will make that trade pay off, but they're counting on it. This is a guy that they never would have had a shot at in the draft. He went number 6 overall, so this is a superstar. Another guy, and this is, I don't know if you guys have noticed this, when I talk to people about some of their favorite players, I notice that especially younger people love DK Metcalf. I think everyone loves DK Metcalf, but I think DK Metcalf is becoming for, you know, younger people who maybe were a little too young for the Legion of Boom, like their version of a really exciting Seahawks star.
Stacey Ross from 710 ESPN Seattle. Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.